Well, those were fascinating stories about Bigfoot, weren't they? Up next, we're going to deal with the occult. Angel Spells, the Enochian Occult Workbook of Charms, Seals, Talismans, and Ciphers. Alan Greenfield with us. We're going to talk about his work in the field of UFOs, strange sightings, and the occult when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Alan Greenfield has been interested in the occult, the unusual, UFOs, paranormal occurrences for, most of his life. He's been an active investigator since the early 1960s. He's traveled the world, and twice now he's been the recipient of the Ufologist of the Year Award of the National UFO Conference. Quite a conference that used to be, Alan. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. We tried very hard, and I think we succeeded beyond the wildest dreams that we had in terms of doing a serious scientific convention for over 40 years, really, and largely because the late Jim Moseley, good friend of mine, sort of kept going as the permanent chairman, and when he turned it over to someone else, that's when it kind of got lost in the that great UFO in the sky.
Yeah, it did.
We still have our annual, sort of reunion meetings, and others are more than welcome to show up at those.
Where did you hold the convention, primarily?
They started out in Cleveland, Ohio. That was because we had a large pocket of what we used to call middle ufologists.
Yeah.
That is, people that were neither contactees on the one end or nuts and bolts, sort of the easy theory of UFOs on the other end. So we used Cleveland for several years, and then we took it to New York and had the biggest UFO convention in history, under Jim Moseley's tutelage. It was like thousands of people, and everybody who was anybody who wasn't dead, and maybe some of those who were, showed up at that, because that was in June 24th, 1967, the summer of love in New York, and it was we never quite equaled that. We did one here in Atlanta many years later that came close to the numbers, but certainly we didn't have Dr. Condon and the amazing Randy as well.
That's
as
right.
Everybody that you can name. So we did quite well.
Have you found, Alan, that the interest in the occult, UFOs, is stronger now or not?
I may say something unpopular here, but I think it's just by the nature of great programs like yours and the not so great stuff on the History Channel. I don't think they like me, or they don't like me anymore. And the internet has caused the interest to be much broader. But in terms of hardcore people involved in serious analysis and investigation, and most importantly, field work, I think it's a lot less, even though the urban myth that UFOs have gone away is really absurd. I mean, part of my gig is doing news every day, and I search for unusual sources, and UFOs are about the easiest thing to find. There's something new every day, either UFOs or strange cryptozoological creatures, or men in black, or the slim men, the women in black, and other assorted denizens of borderland. And I think that it's just that the organized interest essentially involves the same people who were around when I was a kid, except that they're much older, and we don't have a younger generation. The same is true in the occult world, and the occultists are really in denial about that. But there was a huge upsurge, not surprisingly, in the late 1960s and early 1970s. But you see those same people much older now, interested, and not so many young people.
That's right.
I think that it's a phenomenon of the post-war generation, and the millennials are perhaps not nearly as interested in it.
Well, they're interested, Alan, as you know, they're primarily interested in their smartphones and their social networking. And, you know, the research and the time that you have to put in to be a good researcher in any field has gone away.
Well, yeah, I think that that's true. And it probably goes beyond the borderland type phenomena as well. I think you will find that even though there's great progress in science, it's built on momentum. It's like when I was young, I'm sure this was true with you as well, the space program looked like by this time we'd be have colonies on the moon and Mars and be looking at interstellar flight. Now that's good fiction, but has not become the reality because the air has gone out of the balloon to a great extent. I mean, it's going to happen inevitably, but unless we get hit by a comet or something, which mm-hmm. I think is fairly unlikely at any near future.
But you never know.
Well, I've got three sons, so I do worry about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Statistically, it's, unlikely that anything catastrophic, an extinction level event, will happen unless we blow ourselves up. And then, if we're stupid enough to do that, perhaps it's our just desserts. But if that doesn't happen, sooner or later, our slow and sluggish efforts to move out into the universe are going to happen simply because they are happening. They're just happening at a remarkably slow rate. That 10 years between Kennedy's speech and landing on the moon was awe-inspiring for me and for a lot of other people. But after that, it seemed like without the semi-fictional rivalry between the Soviets and the United States, it lost its oomph, for lack of a scientific term. And it's underfunded, and I think that's true in a lot of areas of science. So it's not just confined to the occult and to ufology and to cryptozoology or any of those neat, high weirdness sort of things.
You did a lot of work as a psychic, did you not?
Yeah, I spent 5 years on the graveyard shift with the Psychic Friends Network. And
now, how did that all happen? How'd that come about?
Well, I've been reading tarot cards since early 1960s. So I've had several breakthroughs with that. And along with it is the realization that a lot of it isn't coming from the cards. It's
from
intuitive.
You. Yeah.
And the cards are just sort of a focus for that. And I was managing an art supply store, and one of my friends, now deceased, a guy that was always in near fatal car crashes, and he finally bit the dust. But he said, "You've got to get in on this 900 thing, Alan." I said, "I'm not going to be on a sex line." He said, No. I mean, that was what, was very in that. There's one legitimate outfit that is really riding high, and they're very exacting in who they will allow to work for them.
Do they test them?
Oh, yeah. I got run through the ringer on that. You would do a standard sort of application for a job with the kind of resume you would have for any kind of job. And then you had to do a reading for somebody in-house, a cold reading. And I did a reading for...
In person or on the phone?
On the phone. Everything with them was on the phone. In fact, the ultimate demise of the Psychic Friends Network was I won't go into the technicalities of it, but it was an argument between the IRS and the company that owned the Psychic Friends Network as to whether we were employees, which we were, in my opinion and in the government's opinion, or independent contractors. And the government
wanted their taxes, right?
Right. They didn't want to have to do withholding. And as soon as the government insisted they do withholding, there was a joke at the time, if you were so psychic, how come you didn't know they were going out of business? Well, I knew as soon as the government did that, I didn't have to be psychic. I just had to know American society, the people that were behind it. Our days were numbered, and sure enough, within the next year, they closed down and probably popped up in some other area. Before they were in the Psychic Friends Network, they were doing odds making on races, horse races, and things like that.
How weird. was that a good business for a while, the Psychic Friends Network?
Well, I made a living. It was a living. The graveyard shift was certainly interesting. In those, I had to log each call, and in those 5 years, I talked to, let me see, it was something like 2,500 different people. I think I even saved a few lives because we had a, you had to have a dedicated phone line, and you signed in on the phone. You never saw anybody else that worked for them unless you happened to know somebody. I knew one or two other people that worked for them, but you would occasionally get someone who was suicidal. And
yeah,
what we were supposed to do was use our other line and call 911, which to my way of thinking, having worked for suicide prevention at one time, that was the wrong thing to do. Talking them down was the right thing to do, not send them somewhere else, because they'd start out with the same sort of thing that people, you know, oh, my girlfriend left me and I'm feeling really down. By the way, I'm sitting on a ledge, and I would immediately stop doing psychic and start doing reasons to live. And I believe I talked about less than half a dozen, but we'll say four or five people off the ledge, at least for that night. I mean, you know, I don't know.
Did anybody jump?
No, I never had a jumper, thank God.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, now, this ability that you had, though, this psychic ability, obviously then when they tested you, you passed with flying colors, or they wouldn't have kept you on. Have you been intuitive always?
Maybe. I developed it consciously from the early 1960s on. I started out with reading auras, and at that time there was a it was a training tool, which I have looked for even on eBay. They just disappeared because they were a product of the Venture Bookshop, which was affiliated with the old Fate magazine of Kurt Fuller and Ray Palmer. And once I used the Aura goggles for a couple of months, don't forget I was a teenager at the time, I didn't need them anymore. I was able to see auras and and from that, I went to being able to, I can't read minds, and I wouldn't want to even if I could, so I may actually. But in terms of energy transfer, of reading energy, and of doing predictions, I've been, with my track record is something like 85%.
What is it about the occult, Alan, that so many people are just fascinated with?
I think it's that it is occult, that it's secretive and dark, but at the same time it holds out the promise, really the same promise that mainstream religion, well, most religions offer, which is something beyond the ordinary in life. But it offers a more, shall we say, practical rather than dogmatic approach to it. One can go in a number of different directions, and I've seen people go way, way off the rails into really dark, dark areas that I'm not very fond of, and it usually has catastrophic results, not for other people, but for the person indulging that. But for people who do what I do, which is put that effort into healing and to group work and into developing consciousness, doing what I call congregational illuminism or scientific illuminism, that is systematically looking for greater ways to expand one's consciousness without drugs or other invasive forms of dangerous interplay. I think that it can be very rewarding. And I think that people who take a very casual interest in it look at it from the outside and they think, this is a way to get beyond the day-to-day existence without committing to a particular spiritual ideology. And they're correct.
Well, when you hear the word occult, Alan, a lot of people think it's evil. It's not, is it?
Well, it can be. It's let's not do a Second Amendment program, but I would say it's like a gun. A gun can be used to protect your family, or a gun can be used to kill a bunch of people at a mall. It depends on whose hand that it's in and what the intent of the person who has it in their hand is. The occult has a whole range of organizations and tendencies around it, ranging from Wicca, which professes to be the old religion, which it is not, to the crypto-Masonic associations that I have a much closer relationship with, although I'm very intimately acquainted with various schools of Wicca and neo-paganism as well. And these things don't persuade me in a religious way. I have very conventional Jewish reform religious views, have had all my life. But as paths to greater enlightenment, I think that they really can be. On the other hand, you have these groups that profess an interest in the very darkest side, and you also have spin-offs from the original Church of Satan, which was itself it was sort of Ayn Rand with occultism thrown in, not supernatural. It was just sort of violating taboos in a ritualistic atmosphere. But spun off from that are all kinds of things that are actually believing in demonic forces. And I am virtually certain that those forces exist based on my own experience and the experience of other people, but I'm unalterably opposed to extensive congress with those forces. I would much rather people read something like this book that Beckley put together with me, Tim Beckley, Angel Spell.
Yeah, I like him. He's a good guy.
He's a great guy. I put it this way sometimes. He's my oldest friend. He's younger than me slightly, but I've known him since early 1960s. So he and Gene Steinberg and I go back to what was called the teen ufology movement back in the day.
What did you two mean by angel spells?
Well, it involves a school of occultism or magic, that's magic with a K, called Enochian magic. And Enochian magic is generally considered for experts only. It involves a legend dating from the patriarch Enoch, who was described biblically in a very different way from all the others of that in the book of Genesis, because all the others, it gives a date of death. And with him, there's a peculiar thing that even in the original Hebrew, often the translations are not good. But even
hold on for a second, Alan. We'll get right into this. Angel spells next on Coast to Coast. Well, remember to take a peek at our television show, Beyond Belief. You can simply go to this website, beyondbelief.com, and participate in the free trial, beyondbelief.com. And welcome back with Alan Greenfield. Alan, back to Angel Spells. I love that title, by the way, that you co-wrote with Tim Beckley.
Thank you. It sort of sums up what we're trying to do with the book, which is reduce the complexities of Enochian magic, which there are enormous volumes written over several hundred years into something fairly practical that pretty much ordinary folks can use to their great benefit. There's nothing dark about it. It's there are a couple of things in it that I wouldn't do. I don't believe in love spells. I think that's compelling another human being to bend themselves to your will, and I'm kind of opposed to that.
Would it work, though? Would a love spell work?
Yeah, but the price is very high.
Consequences, huh?
Yes, all magic has consequences, but if what you do is positive, the consequences are positive, too. If what you're doing is essentially enslaving someone's emotions, you may find your own emotions enslaved as well.
Good point.
When I was young and foolish, I tried that once on a young lady that did not return my affections, and I did something relatively strong. And the next day she said, "I consider myself your sister." And she loved me as a sister from then on, and lesson learned.
That was the consequence.
Yeah.
It's like an old Twilight Zone movie, Alan.
Yeah, that was right. I expected Rod Serling to appear in a corner saying, "Alan Greenfield doesn't know it, but he just entered the Twilight Zone."
That's right, exactly.
So we don't go there very much. But angel spells is mostly just reducing this whole corpus that goes back to some of the earliest biblical times, all the way through the Enochian language, which is a true language that Elizabeth I, astronomer royal, John Dee, decoded in the Elizabethan era, obviously, and that has to be pronounced correctly, and in order to gain entry into these portals to what I call otherware, which is probably other dimensions, but I won't presume to know what they are. I just know that you open the portal and stuff happens that wouldn't otherwise happen.
Alan, in your career, have you ever, hate to put you on the spot, have you ever concocted some kind of evil spell or something that you got ticked at somebody and you wanted to get back at them?
You know you wanted to ask.
Of course I wanted to ask.
No, I did. I've been tempted. It's sort of like road rage. My son Randall says that I yell at cars that cut me off, and that's true. But I don't run into them, you know.
Chase them down.
For the same reason, I consider myself ethical and accountable for what I do. So I, you know, count to 10, and even if I look, you can't be in this sort of area for a long time and be opinionated, as I am, without making some enemies. And there are people who have, you know, threatened me, and I've had death threats here and there over the long haul.
By whom?
Well, probably members of the occult organization that I used to be a member of, but I don't know that for certain, and they're very litigious.
So you can't say it.
Too much detail, but I'm still here, so it's very easy to pick up a phone or send an anonymous email or whatever, and I'm still chugging along. On the other hand, you wonder sometimes. My first book, Secret Cipher of the Euphonauts, not to plug it, it's now available in a free PDF, was from Illuminet Press that Ron Bonds was the editor of. He gave me my first real break, and the people that worked there that worked both on conspiracy theories and ufology all died young, including Ron Bonds, which was the end of Illuminet Press. It was one of the few traditional publishers that that published in those areas, and I remember my friend Jim Keith, author of The Black Helicopters and a bunch of other books about conspiracy ideas. We were autographing books together, and Ron Bonds came over to. This was at the National UFO Conference in Atlanta in the, I guess it was about 1995. And He died young under very mysterious circumstances. Ron Bond died, Bonds died under the most mysterious circumstances I've ever heard of that didn't get investigated.
Like they may have been murdered?
I would say that that's extremely likely. And yet I'm still here, you know, not that it's like saying I never broke a bone. I'm a cyclist, so I always think, I don't want to say that too much. I don't want to jinx it at this point in my life, but, you know, I'm a tough bird. And also I don't do conspiracy stuff as a centerpiece. I do investigation of unusual phenomena as a centerpiece. And that may be the reason that I've gotten lots of little warnings over the years, but nothing, you know, nothing fatal. One time I got, I don't like mentioning things that I was alone. I like to mention the ones that there were witnesses to, but I've, you know, that we do this healing event on this obscure power spot near Atlanta, which is where I live in the greater Atlanta area, mm-hmm. called Arabia Mountain. We do that once a month from March through September or October, depending on the weather this year.
Speaking of weather, didn't you do a little manipulation experiment?
Well, there are those that say that I did, and what I did was innocent enough by my standards. I never do rituals on radio. First of all, you can't, because they involve physical acts that you have to be able to see, particularly yeah. like in angel spells, we do have a lot of talismanic magic, and you have to be able to draw the talisman. But I wanted to illustrate for the host of a program out of Portland how simple the rituals were. So I went through one of the rituals in the book, and that night there was, shall we say, a really, really unusual weather pattern in the Portland area, where I have a lot of friends. I spoke there not too long ago, in fact, and we have an affiliate, two affiliate groups out there. So this is Portland, Oregon, which is also near where the famous Maury Allen. Yeah.
Sounds like you were on my buddy Clyde Lewis's show.
It was on Clyde Lewis's
See?
Show.
How about that?
I didn't know that was okay to mention.
Of course. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Doing Clyde's show, something weird happens every time. The last time I was on with Clyde, there was a UFO hovering above his building, and he got all excited at the end of the show and said he was going outside to look for the UFO, and that's, I didn't hear from him for 2 years. This time, I understand. I wasn't listening the next night, but I understand he was saying, Alan Greenfield did this ritual and raised a tornado here. And I said Beckley relayed this information to me. And I said, look, this was of a good angel. If you want to raise a storm, the invocation of Barzabal, which I don't recommend, is the way to go. And I was invoking the archangel Michael, which as an archangel would imply, something very, very close to godly, and hardly something you would invoke to, even if I had actually been doing the ritual. But I did it ritualistically simply to show how simple it was to do these rituals without complex learning of Enochian pronunciations and
well, it worked.
I think Clyde is convinced that I raised a storm, and actually someone was killed in the storm, so I'm not overly joyous about
that. Does that make you liable for it?
If you can convince a court that magic has brought on a storm, I suppose I could be liable for it.
I don't
but
think you can.
I'm a poor man, and the fact is, all they could do is take my TV, you know, and that was given to me by my son in the Navy. there's no way it could have been. What I did suggest, though, was perhaps this was going to be a full-fledged tornado, and perhaps doing a ritual invocation of a good force ameliorated that so that it was just a gale force wind instead of a tornado, which would be catastrophic in a major city like Portland.
We've done some experiments before, Alan, and they've worked. I mean,
Well, of course they work. I wouldn't be doing this for 50 years if it didn't work. I mean, I do think we ought to have more rigid controls.
That's the tough part.
Yeah, but that's what I've been advocating for the last, oh, say, 20 years to a very, very deaf occult community. We ought to be using the same criteria that the paranormal research community, the serious university-based paranormal research community, uses to assess how much of this works and how does it work and what percentage of the time does it do what you expect it to do, etc. I can only go by my own results, and I have occasionally, shall we say, in the earlier parts of my career, missed the mark.
Mm-hmm.
But pretty much, if I do something, it works, and the same is true of those people that I work with, for the most part. Occasionally, you will get somebody that you will do something with that you just pick up that nothing is going to happen. It's like an instantaneous, this was for naught, and it always turns out to be correct in that particular case. And I think that has not more to do not with the energy exchange that goes on, what we call egregore, the mutual exchange of energy, and more to do with the recipient who is not open to receiving it. Because clearly there has to be a kind of openness to giving and openness to receiving if you're going to do something on an individual basis. If you're doing something to kind of stop a storm, that's more impersonal. And on one occasion, I may have saved the life of my whole family by a talisman that was consecrated to protect from foul weather. And a tornado approached our house. This was in the 1970s when we had a spate of tornadoes in the Atlanta area. And I was in the safest place in the house. I was in the bathtub. But, you know, the classical sound, there was a vent, and it sounded like a train.
Oh, sure. That's got that.
Ooh. And my wife and my then only son, my eldest son, said that the windows imploded but didn't actually break. And after the storm, I went outside and took a look, and you could see that the trees had been sheared off at the roots, had jumped over my house, just shearing off the tops of trees over my house, but not coming down. And then as it proceeded beyond my house, went back on the ground and tore the trees out by the roots. So apparently the weather talisman worked for what it was consecrated for. Ironically, that talisman was lost in a house fire because it was not a talisman against fires. It was against weather anomalies. So it has to be very specific. All worked out well, and no one was hurt in that particular instance.
Are you still a UFO investigator?
Yes. If you mean, do I investigate individual cases? Absolutely. I don't do as many field investigations as I once did because I'm pushing 70. But that's what the macaque.
Good for you. Have you come across a doozy of a UFO case that you'll
over the years?
Yeah,
I've come across several doozies. The probably the best is the Brooksville, Florida case. That involved a central character by the name of John Reeves, who I got to know John very well because I visited with him maybe four or five times, and he was kind of a, you know, your traditional character. He had a sign up saying he had a flying saucer landing area. My father went with me once, and he was playing golf in the flying saucer landing area, showing, I guess, his opinion of these things. But if John was telling his story in isolation, you would probably think, well, this is just a nutty old guy who's looking for some attention because he's out here in a rural area and is kind of lonely. And that would have been it. But the local UFO group not too far from there in St. Petersburg and I huddled together, and we did a systematic investigation of the entire area. And it was Brooksville, Newport Richey, in that area was saturated with close encounters of the second kind. That is, you know, no actual contact.
But you see them.
Yes, see them up close and personal. We visited with people that clearly, independently of John Reeves, had had very close encounters with UFOs. Not only that, but we found some unusual anomalies in the area. Sinkholes that were swallowing trucks whole, and that creates certain electromagnetic effects and ley line effects that tend to support John's really hard to buy story in and of itself. And we even found a species of insect that we took it to the insecticides. No, the
entomologist.
Entomologist, yes. And the entomologist had no idea what these things were. Of course, there are uncatalogued species of creatures all over the world, especially in the insect kingdom, because they mutate constantly, like viruses. But nevertheless, this was something that had become common there. And I asked some people who were totally uninvolved in this, and they said, "Yeah, these showed up all of a sudden, right around the time that Reeves guy had that flying saucer experience." And I thought, "Oh, that is very interesting, because John Reeves didn't claim anything outlandish other than this experience. His only claim to fame prior to this was he had a bit part in the silent movie classic All's Quiet on the Western Front. But, you know,
there was a classic.
Yes, it was, and he was a young man at that time, and, you know, he was an extra. So, you know, was in one scene, and I tend to think that that's the most remarkable case. The other one, of course, is the Brown Mountain Lights, which I have twice gone and interviewed many, many witnesses. Once I went with Jim Moseley and Tim Beckley and Jim Moseley's then young daughter, Betty, on Christmas Eve, 1968, I believe it was, when the Apollo 8, was it, that was circling the moon but didn't land?
Yeah, that's right. Were they read from Genesis?
Yes. I got back to the hotel after we were out looking at these weird lights on the mountain, and Moseley was driving, which is a frightening experience on a mountainside with an abyss on one side and an icy road. And we get to the room, and Beckley turns on his TV, and they're reading from the Bible, and I said, "Oh God, something has happened to these guys." It was, you know, they were just doing a Christmas Eve greeting. It was actually, you know, when I saw it later, that was okay. But I thought that they had, you know, had been marooned around the moon or something. But we did see the lights, and I talked to people who had seen them up close, and they seemed very intelligent. I talked to the guy who said that he had been inside the mountain and had met the inhabitants who, essentially, that it was a Brown Mountain was a UFO landing area.
Yeah, lots of reports there. Alan, we're going to come back. We'll talk more about your life in the occult, and we'll take some phone calls next.